Welcome to the Two Daft Yanks Podcast, the show that brings you tidbits from all aspects of the soccer world. Sometimes serious, sometimes zany, always opinionated. Now, here are your hosts, Chad Smith and Corey Chatelain.
This is the Two Daft Yanks Podcast. I am your host, Chad Smith, and I'm joined by my co-host, the Lord Baelish of Soccer Podcast co-host, Mr. Corey Chatelain.
Ooh, man, that's a pretty good intro, because some people would call me an up-jump jackanape for sure. But man, how about that Mike Riley, huh? Putting in a Ballon d'Or type performance on Sunday is awesome. Mike Riley for Player of the Year.
All right, folks, so you can see Corey is fired up, and I am fired up as well, because usually this is the part of the show where we tell you what's going on. But we are going to skip the appetizer, and we are going to jump right into the main course, because we are excited to bring you what we are going to bring you. So we will get to the talking points from this week in the Premier League, but first, we are going to bring you an interview, and we are pleased as punch to bring it to you. It is from Sean Reed, who is writing a unique soccer book.
Yeah, really comprehensive book as well. Goes through the culture and through the history of soccer in America, but from like the fans' point of view. So I think people are going to like it.
Yes, I do as well. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Sean Reed that we had this weekend. We are pleased to be joined on the Two Daft Yanks hotline by author Sean Reed, who is here to talk about his forthcoming book, Love Thy Soccer. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Hi, guys. Great to be here.
All right. Let's just get straight into this. For those who are unfamiliar about Love Thy Soccer, can you tell us the concept of your project?
Absolutely. It's a book about soccer in the U.S. from the fan's point of view. The fan in my book is basically anyone who's had a hand in pushing the game forward, be it a supporter group member, people in the front office for both clubs and the league, anyone playing the game right now or have played it in the past. I've spoken to a lot of former players, including some legends like Marcelo Balboa, Casey Keller, Alexi Lalas. I talk about issues that all fans pretty much discuss all the time, such as youth development, whether or not players should go abroad or hone their skills at home and develop the league here. The women's game, our American conventions, and the infamous Pro Rel even gets some looks in my book. And in doing so, I've been talking to over 300 people from around the country, both from the amateurs all the way up to the pros, both the supporters and the administrators of the game, and including some historians, retailers, innovators, and authors. So it's pretty much the most comprehensive book I believe ever written on American soccer, and it's essentially a celebration of where the game is today at all levels of the pyramid across the country.
All right, and I'm glad that you mentioned the word comprehensive, because after reviewing your website and your press release and stuff, that's the number one thing that popped in my head, that this is very comprehensive project.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
Yeah, and that's I was pleased to see that too, because I think that's one of the things that sometimes people who aren't in the soccer culture don't realize, that it's, you know, to use the cliche, that soccer is kind of more than a sport, but it really is, because it just crosses so many avenues, even within the sport, but over into the cultural and social world as well.
Absolutely. I don't just talk about the ins and outs and the mechanisms behind the game and the way it works and why it works the way it works. I'm also looking at those things you're talking about, Corey, like American value set, charity, some of those less tangible things about the game, or those things about the game that probably get less exposure than the game itself. So it really looks at basically a crosscut of where the game is culturally right now, both in its development and expansion here in the U.S., and also what it means to America. I think that the game, in a lot of ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I'm sure you hear the same thing, he usually is a target for a number of different ways. You know, maybe anti-soccer fans who love sport but just don't like soccer for whatever reason, or for the political opponents to the game who equate it to some kind of foreign entity or foreign other. I kind of take aim at that too, basically saying that soccer has not only existed in the U.S. for a while, but embodies a lot of these same American values which you purport to profess. And I think that soccer is a sport that has something for everybody. It's very much a sport for the common man. And I think that that's pretty much the foundation upon which America is built. And one of the reasons why, even though it hasn't gotten the exposure it has in the last few years, is the reason why it's been so successful of late, and why it's endured over time.
Oh, that is definitely the case. We agree spot on with that. We talk about that a lot here on the show. So I guess here's a question now. You say out front that you're by no means an expert, but you're a top-class researcher. So was there anything in your research or in your interview process that greatly surprised you that you did not expect to, you know, hear or see?
Well, I hope I never made the claim that I'm a top-class researcher. I've just been researching a whole heck of a lot over the last 5 years, and a lot of my research has come through fan interaction, people that are either experts or have a close relationship with the game that can either tell me what I don't know or point me in the direction of someone who does. Things that have surprised me over time were, I think, how deep the history goes. I mean, we all know that, you know, Colin Joes, whom I actually had a chance to meet in Canada, by the way, great guy. He had basically the formative history on the NASL and, more importantly, the ASL, the first American soccer league back in the 20s. But the history goes back even further than that, to where we saw the divisions in the late 1800s between the running game and the kicking game, the divisions between the way Harvard insisted it be played and the way a lot of other small FAs within those early Ivy League schools actually started playing the game. I don't really spend a lot of time in the weeds, but I do talk to people and have interviewed people that have had a lot of their lives devoted to uncovering that research. And there's one guy in particular that I really like. He's from Asheville, North Carolina. His name's Mel Smith. A lot of fans don't know who this guy is, but he basically went back, did all the research from the late 1800s on through into the early 1900s, and talking about the differences between rugby, the American kicking game, American football, and association football, the difference between foot and ball, football. It all sounds really dry, but the way I've presented in the book kind of gives a compelling narrative to help us understand, as true fans, people that really follow the game and who care about this stuff, more of a baseline understanding of how we came to where we are today. And that's just in the first chapter. So if that gives you an idea of the overview and scope of the whole book, it's basically illustrated stories by fans who are in the know or have some really fun or amazing stories to share. Another one is Timber Jim out in Portland, his original story. A lot of fans know that, but I try to describe it in a way that's touching and heartfelt and really kind of gives people outside of Portland or who haven't really delved into that story a chance to explore and see what that team really means to him as a fan and their de facto mascot for the last 20 years before Timber Joey.
And Sean, obviously you just touched on most of this, but exactly how far back does the book go into soccer history? Because that's something I know, like most of my friends, when I talk to them about soccer that aren't into it, they don't truly understand that, you know, technically speaking, and since I am a soccer fan, I will use the technical definition that soccer even predates, as you said, football in this country. So I'm assuming it goes back to the 1870s or so, because I think the first official football date is given for 67 for Princeton and Yale, I believe, for the first football game. But so how far back does you know, the history actually go?
I go back to the McGill-Harvard game as basically a seminal moment in the transition that we went through in this country between the kicking game and the running game. And it was basically a contest between a Quebecian, probably mispronouncing that, sorry, McGill, a university from Quebec, from Montreal, coming down and taking on Harvard. Harvard was looking for opponents to play its style of football. And again, this was back when we were defining foot and ball with a space or dash. But basically, it wasn't soccer, and it wasn't American football yet. But basically, they were running the game, and they were looking for opponents to play their style of what would be early gridiron football. That's kind of where, it's not where I start the book, but it's kind of like where we start seeing the shift. So I put a lot of onus onto the Canadians and on Harvard for basically making that transition and making that decision for us that football, as we know it in America today, would be the kind of game that would be carried and run rather than the kicking game football, which were being played by many of the association FAs. Harvard had a lot of clout back then, and they were able to basically, because they were the biggest and the best, the oldest college in America, they were able to compel a lot of other other schools to kind of follow their lead. So if it weren't for the Canadians and it wasn't for Harvard basically impressing upon us their need to play football their way, you know, we may have encountered a different set of history going forward.
Mm-hmm. No, that McGill-Harvard match certainly is famous, and if listeners don't know more about it, I urge you to do the research, and there's plenty of material out there to read about it, because it is fascinating.
Yeah, I don't dwell on that. I mean, it's basically a page and a half explaining what happened, but the book is not so, it's not so cut and dry. And I'm trying to encourage us as fans to really accept and appreciate the history that we have. You know, if you want to call it football, that's fine, but there's nothing wrong with calling it soccer. That's another big debate we have. I devote a chapter to why America names things the way it does and how crazy names in other countries are, how our league calendar works. There's a lot of things which Alexi Lawless coined in the phrase Americanness, which I took on and put together in these scarves that I'm releasing in tandem with the book. And it's a phrase that I think kind of carries the underlying tone throughout the piece, which is it's a different game here, granted, but it's a different game everywhere. And just because it's the English game that came from England, it was farmed out and exported across the world. And so you can find a lot of strange conventions in other countries, the way they run their oversight, the way they run their leagues, their calendars even. But the way we do things in America doesn't delegitimize the game here. In fact, it in many ways makes it just as fun, if not more so, I think, for some to watch.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to lead us into our next question that I know Corey has ready.
Yeah, because Sean, I don't know how much you've listened to the show in the past, but Chad and I both, you know, mainly in a joking way, we're admitted Euro snobs when it comes to soccer. But a lot of that, you know, a lot of that has to do with you know when I first started getting really interested in soccer, there just wasn't a viable league over here. You know, I mean, when I was a young kid, I can barely remember the NASL, and you know that folded in the mid 80s, mid to late 80s. So when I really got interested in 1990, there just wasn't a viable league. So obviously I had to search that out, and that led me to, you know, places like England and Italy and Germany, France, etc. So with that said, Chad and I are always interested in, you know, the whole. Or, you know, one of the big topics we're always interested in, both on the show and, you know, just in general, is the whole, you know, the MLS fan versus, you know, the Euro snob. So what's your take, or, you know, I guess, how do you cover that in the book?
The Euro snob chapter that I wrote about basically talks about American insecurity, and I know that might come off as an insult to people that do call themselves Eurosnobs or even look at it as a pejorative. Those people that pretty much follow European football over American soccer, these are the people that basically MLS has been trying to court, as you guys know, as they grow the league, and I think that they've had a lot of success in kind of bringing people around by doing the things that a lot of European football followers have been complaining about for a long time, which is, you know, the lack of play, the lack of big money talent, the you know, the football lines on the field. I mean, these are all things that I think soccer fans, whether you follow it in Europe or America, really don't like to see. I find that the common problem with following only European football or only Mexican football, you don't need to keep it just on one continent, is that you're doing so at the expense of your own development at home. So it's fine to make your first love, say, the English Premier League. I know you guys focus a lot on that. But for me, as a fan who wants to see my game grow, I would like to put this forward, saying that, you know, we don't have to be looking down on the league we have, but rather looking at where it needs to get to. And the best way to do that is not through blind support, but I think avid campaigning for the increase in the things that we need. So you definitely need to vote with your feet. And I think that in order to do so, you need to be involved, and you need to take, if not an interest, at least take some initiative and make yourself a little bit more aware on where the league is and the thing that it's done to grow so far. So you can't just take a back seat and say, well, it's not where I want it yet. You have to be able to articulate why it's not there yet and why you want it there, and actually know what the teams have been doing to kind of get it to where you would like to see it be. So then you can actually have a more ardent voice and some involvement. I think that a lot of people look outside of the community and they say, I don't have a stake in that, therefore it's not to my liking. But those who become involved start to follow it. And it's also a question for TV. You know, how do we get people that are fans of one MLS team in one market to watch a game on the East Coast? Let's say you're a Portland fan. What interest do you have in watching an Eastern Conference matchup between Union and Red Bulls? You know, virtually none, especially if it's early in the season. But if you're able to look at it from a bigger scope and say, you know, I want to see how they're performing, how they play, how, you know, what their signings have done, you know, what the league's looking like on TV in general. Those are kind of the interests, I think, that invested people have. So you're not just looking at where the league is, and you're looking at where it could be, where it could grow to. And yet you have to know what you're talking about in order just to take a negative stance.
No, I think that's very well said. And we try to make some of those points on the show about, you know, this is what we'd like to see MLS and the American soccer pyramid go towards. So, no, I think you have a well-balanced view that I think most people would agree with. Yes, that is the path forward, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, so to say.
Yeah, no, sorry. I was just going to add that, yeah, because I think the problem with that comes is, like, with any divide, you know, no matter where it is in life, and especially with the propensity of things to quickly heat up on the internet, I think the problem with that sometimes comes just, you know, people, they, once they divide themselves into those camps, they're just, you know, it becomes more about winning the argument rather than actually helping the league or a club move forward. And as you were stating, you know, listening to what the other person, you know, he may not like something, but as you said, he might have a reason, and why is that reason that he doesn't like that? You know, it's like I said, that's sometimes what I've found, though, that is that it seems like when people tend to divide themselves in these camps, it becomes more about winning the argument rather than actually, you know, helping each other understand where they want each other's leagues or, you know, their idea of the league to go.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, man. I don't think it needs to be anything that's mutually exclusive. I think that one thing America has been able to do over the years as a country, and one of the reasons for its success, is that we've been able to integrate a lot of the best practices that we've seen from overseas and bring people from foreign cultures and nations into our own American ethic, which again goes back to that Americanness that Alexi coined in his book. And I really think that soccer should be no different. If we really want to succeed, and MLS has stated that it wants to be the best league in the world by the time we have the 2022 World Cup, we're going to have to do those things. And I think it's going to be an effort to pull the acumen that we have from those people that are experienced in working soccer issues overseas, because we are underdeveloped, I think, in a lot of different ways, but also bring fans into the fold. And one of the great things about American soccer, I think, you don't see those leagues you follow overseas, say in Spain or in Germany. Maybe Germany's okay, but certainly in England, is that while there's certainly fan passion, you don't see the same level of fan involvement outside of your supporter groups here. You have a lot of fan-driven initiatives like these podcasts that are, I think, a rarity in a lot of soccer countries, especially in Europe and certainly in Central and South America, because they already have that institution built. It's already woven into the culture, where you have a lot of fan-borne initiatives here in the States that are helping propel it to a greater level. And I think that that's one of the chief aspects, which I think is the most exciting about being an American fan today.
All right, let's get into the really important stuff, and that is, where can our listeners find your book?
It's going to be out in May. Going to be putting it out both digitally and through all the major outlets like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, so you can buy hard copies or get a digital version. I'm accepting pre-orders now. You can get them through PayPal, via PayPal on my site. It's www.lovethysoccer.com. Does anyone say www anymore?
I just did, so the answer is yes.
Knee jerk, yeah. So lovethysoccer.com is where you find it. I'm always happy to field questions about it on Twitter, and you can email me through my webpage. But basically, the book is it's still being refined. I'm working with Robert Jonas, who's covering the San Jose's earthquakes for a long time in the Bay Area, and he's basically taking everything that I've written. We're whittling it down to a really fine point. And I've got a lot of help along the way from some great graphic artists. The book will have a lot of great art in it, some excellent photos of some scarves from one of the greatest collections of North American fan scarves we have in the country. And I think that it's going to be something that people are really going to enjoy picking up and thumbing through, if not reading. So that's where you get the book, and I'm always around if anyone has any questions.
All right, great. And again, you're on Twitter, and it's at Love Thy Soccer.
That's it. That's how you find me.
All right, so track them down, folks. Corey, do you have anything to add?
Just one last thing that I did some quick research. Apparently the people who use the www are known as the tri-dubs or the www snobs.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I'll try to wean myself off that habit then.
Yeah, no, that's... Sure. That's just me interjecting the obligatory daftness that lends the title to our show. So,
I love it.
All right, Sean. So thank you for taking time out of your day to speak with us. And
yeah, thanks, Sean.
And once the book is out and we've had a chance to read it, we'd love to have you on again. So maybe we could talk about more of these issues.
Yeah. I'd love to be back on, and you guys can definitely point out where I missed the boat or where I messed up. But I could talk about this stuff all day long. So thanks again for bringing me on board.
All right, and we are back. Wow, that was a very good interview, Corey. I really enjoyed talking to Sean. What do you think?
Yeah, like I said, I definitely enjoyed it because. As we talked about in that interview, that's one of the things that interests me and apparently people like Sean a lot about soccer, is that there's so much more going on, just from cultural and social points of view, and that it's, to use the cliche like we did in the interview, it's more, it's more than a sport for the people who are into it. So
all right, now we did mention this in the interview itself, but just as a friendly reminder, you can go to twodaftyanks.com, and in the post of this podcast is a link to Sean's website, lovethysoccer.com, and that is where you can pre-order the book and plus get one of them awesome epic scarves.
Yes, definitely get a scarf. It's that's my goal now, is to get the scarf that reads epic Americanness and wear it in Europe at some point, just to annoy people.
Yes, so I think it is a book that every soccer enthusiast will enjoy. It's going to be something that hasn't been done, as we said in the interview. So get to the website, twodaftyanks.com, click on the link, read more about the book, read more about Sean, and pre-order that sucker. Corey, silence.
Yeah, my silence just means I concur with everything you say. I don't have anything to add.
Okay. So, all right, let's now we will do a rundown. We are going to talk about the fallout from Sunderland-Chelsea.
Yeah.
And then there's
madness.
Yes, and then there's further fallout of the most epic kind from Everton-Manchester United. Then we will take a look at the relegation battle, and then we will wish somebody a very hearty congratulations at the very end. So you ought to stick around to see who deserves the Two Daft Yanks pat on the back. And it isn't us. We're not going to be that daft. Okay, where we say, hey, yeah, we're awesome. Thanks for listening. No.
Yeah, well, not today.
But we do thank you for listening.
Yes, yes.
So, all right, let's talk about this. From this weekend at the near the top of the table is Chelsea, obviously. They slipped up. Was it a week ago or 2 weeks ago now against Crystal Palace?
I think it was 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I already forgot.
Yeah, me too. Everything's flying by, especially with the Easter holiday being this last or yesterday. And so Sunderland won. They beat Chelsea 2-1, and that was Sunderland on the road, which is pretty surprising.
Yeah, it's Mourinho's first loss at the Bridge
in a very long time.
Ever, I thought they said.
I think that's right. Or back from like 06, 07, from his first stint.
Yeah, it was like 78. Early. Yeah, it was like 78 games or something. So mm-hmm. I think that's his first loss ever. Or in the Premier League, I thought.
Mm-hmm. But what took center stage was Mourinho's comments after the match against match official Mike Dean.
Yes, and the Mike Dean's boss, Mike Riley, as well. Mike Dean missed a few decisions, probably. Chelsea would argue, but no more than any other match, you know, that a ref would do. And certainly from Chelsea's standpoint, they have no right to complain to that to the level Mourinho did with, you know, as many breaks as they got early in the season with things like the, you know, the West Brom penalty where, who was it? Ramirez just flat out dove to win the penalty kick in stoppage time to win the game. So, yeah, I don't know. Mourinho's comments, and, you know, if anybody hasn't seen him by now, I suggest you do it because, you know, he did it in typical Mourinho style where he basically acted like a 10-year-old. Like I said, it was ridiculous even for Mourinho. And like I said, as many breaks as big clubs like Chelsea get, they certainly have no right to complain to the level Mourinho did where he basically called out the integrity of the entire refereeing community, which, you know, we as fans do, but we're fans. You know, we're not coaches for one of the largest clubs in England and Europe. You know, that's I don't know. It was pretty disgraceful, if you ask me. But, you know, whatever. That's par for the course for Chelsea. So whatever.
And unprofessional. Well, you know, us fans are one of the highest paid managers in all of world football.
Well, yeah. Well, that's what I mean. I mean, you know, unhinged rhetoric and irrational emotional responses are basically what's expected of some fans. But like you said, not from a manager that not only is the highest paid, but that is one of the most successful managers in recent European history. And, you know, it's not his first rodeo. It's not like he's been around for just a year or two. I mean, he's been a top-level manager for over a decade now, and he's, you know, comes out and now he's acting like a 10-year-old. It's getting to the point where it's almost like he's regressing. I don't know if emotionally is the right word, but the way he handles his his outburst or his subtle little mind games, whatever you want to call it, after matches when he loses, which, you know, to be fair, is still pretty infrequently, but they're getting more and more childish and less coherent, you know, as time goes on. So yeah, I don't know if it's pressure from Abramovich or what.
But let's just say even Tim Sherwood thinks he needs to cool it down a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's like I said, it's one thing to be really pissy and aggravated after a game, but like I said, the way Mourinho did it was just completely unprofessional. So,
and this is almost a carbon copy of when he did it last time, what, maybe 4 to 6 weeks ago, where he said the same thing, oh, I congratulate the referee on a great performance.
Yeah.
This is the second time he's done this now, this season.
Well, but like I said, even the way, and again, I'm a very sarcastic person myself, so I can understand the way, what he's doing when he says certain things, because even before you get to that point, or, you know, even before you get to that comment, he's setting it up, basically, you know, because he's saying, the way he, I forgot exactly how he said it, but he's like, I'm only going to make 4 points, and I'll be really quick. So what he's basically doing there is, you know, he's telling people he's going to limit the time so that they're going to be paying attention to the quick points he makes. And then the points he makes, of course, he comes off, you know, with the with the obviously sarcastic, I would, like you said, I would like to congratulate Mike Dean. It was a very good performance, and would also like to congratulate Mike Riley for scheduling the referees the way they do, blah, blah, blah. So like I said, it's one of those where I think he still thinks he's being clever and, you know, kind of doing the traditional, like, the smart academic type of argument of style where, you know, you're trying to be pedantic and, you know, fake, you know, whatever you call it, fake congratulations, whatever. But, you know, I think his time of doing that, you know, people are on to him now. And, you know, what was working before doing that, like I said, the English media is quickly losing their patience with that stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm. And I think the reason he's doing this, it's just a classic case of deflection. He doesn't want the media or us as fans or us as podcasters to talk about the club and its performance, and he's getting exactly, instead of talking about Chelsea being terrible and losing to Sunderland, the team who has the worst record in the Premier League, we're talking about his antics.
Yes, but the end goal for that is for Chelsea to then play better, obviously. But I think even that's not working. Excuse me, even that's not working anymore. So yeah, we're still talking about it, but his actual end goal still isn't being met, because, like I said, at this point, I don't think they're, you know, the way Ramirez is also seemingly going off every other game, you know, with his antics of going after people off the ball now, it just kind of seems like there's a little stuff like that kind of leads me to believe that there's something going on at Chelsea with, you know, like I said before, I don't know if it's, you know, extra pressure from Abramovich or if, you know, Mourinho not winning the league, he's put too much pressure on himself behind closed doors, and this is his avenue of you know, kind of diffusing that or, you know, deflecting, you know, that from into the public or whatever. But yeah, so like I said, it just, I think everybody, you know, ever since he's made the specialist and failure comments about Wenger, I think everybody's quickly kind of got off of the Mourinho bandwagon, and like I said, everybody's starting to really lose patience with him quickly, with, you know, with these what are now being seen as asinine, kind of childish type of comments, where before they were, you know, they were more along the lines of, oh, look at Mourinho being so clever and funny.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that was interesting to me was after the Sunderland penalty, which was drawn by Jozy Altidore.
Yeah, Jozy Altidore.
You had one of Chelsea's assistants just going berserk, and you have a theory about this.
Yeah, because apparently it was Chelsea's fitness coach. So, I don't know. I just consider Mourinho such a Machiavellian type of personality that it would not surprise me if Mourinho actually rehearses this kind of stuff, and he actually has people appointed that, and especially after he got sent off for similar type of antics after the Villa match that it wouldn't shock me at all if Mourinho designates people now that, okay, so-and-so, you're just a fitness coach, so you go mental on the ref, and that way I can kind of bitch at the ref during the match without actually getting sent to the stands, and or, you know, that way I can do my Mourinho causing a scene without actually causing a scene. And then I'll just take care of it in the press conference and make my goofy comments then. Now, again, I may be completely irrational with that, but that's my theory.
Okay. And it is. It's a theory, and any theory regarding Mourinho is valid because, you know, you get 9 different psychologists to study this guy, and they're probably going to be baffled, each and every one of them.
Yeah, because like I said, I just consider him my little side psychology from watching him at the matches. He just strikes me as one of the most Machiavellian people around. So like I said, I wouldn't put anything past him. So
all right, we're already wasting too much time on this.
Yeah.
So let's pick up the pace here and let's keep things short because we have to get through the rest of the content here. But now let's move on to what could be one of the biggest results in the history of Manchester United.
Moyes in
forever! The rumors today is Everton 2, Manchester United 0. It is the first double since 1970 for Everton over Manchester United. And this result makes sure that Manchester United is out of the Champions League for the first time in 19 years. Now, in the wake of this, Corey, the rumors have been rife. Is that the right word? I think it is.
Yeah, what's
that? David Moyes is now out, and he will be sacked at some point, either, you know, during the season or shortly after.
Boo. And keep him forever.
And this report comes from, the first report who broke this, according to what I've been reading, is from a reporter by the name of Mark Ogden. And what is the last bit of breaking news that Mr. Mark Ogden got correct? Can you take a guess?
That the lasagna was tainted for Spurs. I have no idea.
No, that he was the first one to report that Sir Alex was going to, in fact, retire.
Oh.
So this leads me to believe that Moyes is out. And there's so many people with different sources reporting this now. I do believe it will be fact. I think David Moyes will be out at some point in time. Now, it could happen tomorrow. It could happen later this week. It could happen at the end of the season. But I do believe his time is done. And here's another theory I have, and I didn't think of this myself, but someone pointed this out, and I tend to agree. Now, do you remember, it's been a little while back now, but the press reported that Robin Van Persie had a clause in his contract that said if Manchester United did not make the Champions League, he'd be free to seek another club. So do you think it's a coincidence that Manchester United has been eliminated from Champions League? And now they've decided that Moyes is out. Do you think it's possible he had a clause in his contract saying if you don't make it, if you do not qualify for the Champions League, then we can, you know, sack you with a discounted payout?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible because, yeah, a lot of times there's all sorts of little clauses in those contracts that aren't made public until, you know, obviously they're triggered and they come out. Now, if that's the case, then yeah, if I was Man U, if that's actually in there, yeah, I would trigger that sucker as soon as possible. And again, maybe that is the reason why sometimes some of these clubs do give contracts, you know, like 6 years or Alan Pardew's ridiculous 8 years because they actually do have an ace in the hole release clause that they can trigger if things go really poor. Because yeah, I'm definitely of the opinion usually that, you know, no matter how good your manager is, anything more than a 3-4 year contract, you're kind of asking for trouble.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens there. We could wake up in the morning and it could be official, or it could drag out to the end of the season. But the other reporting along with these rumors is that if he is sacked with games left, Ryan Giggs would be appointed caretaker manager.
Yeah, no, I did see that today because apparently he's also the Giggs is the is third in the betting for you know, next manager or something.
Oh, geez, that's crazy. I can't see that happening.
Yeah. Well, just to take over, as you said, if Moyes is sacked, it, you know, it didn't necessarily mean long-term manager, but just the next manager.
Oh, I got you. That's true. Okay, I see that type of line. So, yeah. Now, we warned you that this was a possibility in the summer. And if you don't believe us, you could go back to the 2 Daft Yanks archives. And when we talked about this, we both were not sold on Moyes. But we thought that over time he would get the job done. But I could understand why United is doing what they're doing. And with that said, let's get one last laugh in, just in case it's the last time we can do it.
Yeah, Schadenfreude. Yeah, because one last thing on Moyes. Let it also be known that with Moyes failing, technically this means Ferguson has also failed. Thank you.
That is true. And from my listening of British radio earlier today, a lot of the vitriol and anger was towards the Glazers. But do remember,
Americans.
Moyes was the handpicked successor of Ferguson.
Yes, although I did hear somebody say, and again, I wouldn't put it past Fergie either, that he picked Moyes, you know, not thinking it would go quite this bad for Man U this quickly, but picked Moyes knowing that he would never be nearly as successful just to make his legacy better, mm-hmm. or even better than it already is.
Yeah, and we mentioned this in the podcast where we discussed this when it was first announced that Moyes would be the manager at Manchester United, but you never want to be the guy who replaces the guy. That just doesn't work out.
You never want to be the guy after the legend. You'll never live up to it.
So, David Moyes, I lied. We're going to get one more last laugh at you.
We're all going to laugh at you.
But as we said, we wish that he would stay as long as he would like, because if United is going to be this limp, man, it would be great.
Well, yeah, how is he going to finish destroying United if you fire him, you know?
All right, so we talked about the
top. Fire next, Spurs.
Yeah, so we talked about the top of the table with Chelsea. We talked about mid-table with Manchester United, and now we're going to go to the bottom of the table. Yeah, I know. You like how I worked that in there?
Yeah, that's nice.
So now we're going to talk about the bottom of the table.
Yeah.
And that is with this relegation battle. And
ooh, man, it's getting interesting.
It is, really. It's way more interesting than the title race. But the title race could be turned on its head if Chelsea can beat Liverpool this weekend. That would make things really interesting. The top will become very interesting. But the bottom right now, just a few weeks ago, we were reading, and most people were, reading the death rights to Sunderland, Fulham, and Cardiff. But they have each gotten results to where, you know, probably two of them could probably find a way to escape, perhaps. At least one will, I do believe. One will stay alive. And the question is who. So let me just give you the remaining fixtures for these clubs, and I'll remind you, Sunderland's at the bottom on 29 points, but they have a game in hand on the other. So they have to play, they host Cardiff, they go to Manchester United, and then they host West Brom and Swansea. Then you got Fulham on 30 points. They host Hull, they travel to Stoke, and then they host Crystal Palace. Cardiff on 30 points as well. They travel to Sunderland, so that's going to be key. They have Newcastle on the road, and then they host Chelsea on the last day. And then you got Norwich, who's been dragged into this, and their schedule's pretty brutal. Now they have Manchester United on the road, they're at Chelsea, and then they close out at home against Arsenal.
Yeah, and it seems like we have to revise this every week, but yeah, Norwich is probably the best bet to go down now, especially with that schedule.
No, it's definitely the case. That's what a lot of the betting public are saying. And Sunderland has that extra game, which is going to prove invaluable, I do believe.
Yeah, and then you also mentioned one of the teams playing Crystal Palace, who was once at the bottom of the table. And for Pete's sake, they're like in the top half of the table in 10th place now or something, I thought. It's like, For once, I got to congratulate. Well, actually, not for once, because I congratulated them after they beat Chelsea. But you know, that's twice in 1 year. I got to take my hat off to Pulis. It's ridiculous.
Yes, Crystal Palace is currently in 11th place, 1 point back of Stoke, who's in 10th. So they do have a shot to finish in the top half of the table, which would be pretty amazing considering where they started from.
Yeah, with, you know, Shamak, your top striker, Tony Pulis is your manager. It's madness.
Yeah, did you? I didn't know Shamak was so old. He's 30. Did you know that? He turned 30, I think, this week.
Yeah, I didn't realize he was that old, but yeah, I knew he was at least in his mid to late 20s.
Okay. Yeah, I thought he was younger. I thought he was like in his early 20s.
Yeah, no, because he had played at Bordeaux for like 6-7 years, I think.
Mm-hmm. So the relegation battle is going to be key. And I guess we hope, for Jose Altidore's sake, that they find a way to stay up. Now, I don't know if Sunderland stay up, if he'll stick around. But at least it would remove the possible stain of him being on a relegated squad.
Yeah, because obviously a lot of people would argue, you know, that playing in the second division, you know, you're an international, you're U.S. is one of the U.S. top strikers, the level of play is going to fall off, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I mean, I'm a Euro snob, but, you know, I've watched European soccer enough that I would argue the championship is far more competitive and a higher level than MLS would be overall. So if he were to stay in for Sunderland, although I don't think he would, because I would imagine being an international, he's probably on pretty good wages that they wouldn't want to pay in the championship. That, like I said, even if he were to stay on it, I don't think it would be that big of a deal in terms of the level of play, or, you know, how it would possibly affect his international form.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I agree as well. If they go down, he will be looking for a new club, and more than likely in the MLS. But there have been some interesting rumors about his future, and we will get more into that, or a little teaser into that, at the very end of the show. So the key this week, I guess, is the Sunderland-Cardiff match. That is this weekend. So that will be very good. And we'll see. I haven't looked. I'm sure it's already been announced. But I've been impressed with NBC and their coverage, to where they've been putting a lot of these relegation battles in their national slots on TV instead of playing the big clubs, so to speak. So fair play to NBC for doing that.
Yeah, and like we talked in the past, in terms of the story and, you know, of just what makes the league and soccer, promotion, relegation, etc., interesting, NBC gets it much more than, you know, the knuckleheads at Fox do.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying.
Well, but, yeah, just meaning that, you know, because Fox had the EPL coverage for almost a decade, and, you know, they would still concentrate on the top of the table and Champions League, where, like I said, NBC understands that the bottom of the table relegation fights are part of what makes the end of the year, you know, in a league, you know, part of what makes the league so freaking interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right, now it's to the point of the show where we reveal the tease, and I told you that we would give someone a round of applause and congratulate them, so let's do it now. And that round of applause from the non-existent 2 Daft Yanks studio audience.
What do you mean?
Goes to Burnley.
Ah, oh, Burnley.
Today with their bank holiday win has clinched promotion into the Premier League. So now we have another Northwestern club to join the ranks of those up there to maybe kind of balance out the North versus South power, I guess you could say. But Burnley,
one of the original top division clubs too, I believe.
There you go. See, so Burnley is back in the Premier League, and they, of course, join Leicester City, who have already clinched promotion. So Leicester and Burnley are coming up next year. And here are the four teams who currently sit in the playoff spots, which I love the playoffs for the championship. It's great. In third place is Derby County on 81 points. Fourth place is Queen's Park Rangers at 76 points. Fifth place is Wigan at 70 points. And then Brighton at 66 points. Also in the mix with, you know, two or three matches left in the championship, depending on who you are, is Nottingham Forest on 65, Ipswich on 65, Reading on 64, and Blackburn on 64. And then I guess you could even say Bournemouth only three back at 63. So it is really exciting to see who will be into the playoff spots. And given how Wigan has turned into, you know, kind of FA Cup specialists, you would have to think that the format might favor them if they could hold on to a spot.
Yeah, because like QPR, they have a pretty big squad for a championship side. So, you know, if there's any key injuries or anything just prior to the playoffs or in the first leg of the playoffs, they could probably overcome that because, like I said, for a championship squad, they have a pretty good bit of depth. And a lot of their guys have Premier League experience to begin with. So, like I said, that was kind of one of the misnomers in the whole, well, how come Arsenal couldn't beat a championship side? Which, you know, I mean, obviously they would still be near the bottom of the table in the Premier League, but, you know, I mean, half of the guys in that lineup and, you know, several others that didn't even play have Premier League experience. So, you know, they could be, you know, like in baseball terms, you have players or what are called 4A. You know, Wigan could arguably be called like a championship plus squad or something.
Ooh, I like the ring of that.
Yeah, championship plus, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a... I don't know. I don't know what it sounds like, but it sounds like something...
Yeah, it sounds like a pay-per-view TV package for the championship playoffs.
Oh, okay, there we go. We should start that.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, so... just getting a little housekeeping before we adjourn for today. Next week, Corey will not be here.
What? Oh, yeah. Oh.
Where are you going, Corey?
I'm going to Portland. Ooh. Get some to a big rock and roll show.
That's right. And to mix and mingle with the Timbers Army.
Sure. If they're at the Mastodon concert, yeah, come say hi to me.
So, all right, so be looking for Corey. He'll be at the Mastodon concert out there in PDX. And in his stead, we have gotten the services of our favorite Two Daft Yanks guest, and that is the 12th Yank, Mr. Joe Gould, will be on in co-hosting duties.
Yeah, I'm just hoping, you know, when I return, I'm not Wally Pipp and Joe ends up being Lou Gehrig.
Mm-hmm. So next week we will certainly talk about the Premier League, but we will focus on Joe's expertise and we'll try to get an update on how the Americans are doing abroad from, you know, from first teams down to the youth level, which he tracks it all. So be sure to tune into that.
Yeah, his work on Twitter with, like you said, even like U20 guys for Mexican clubs and stuff, it's pretty impressive.
So we'll get an update from him. And I guess before we leave today, we would like to just say thanks again to Sean Reed for joining us. Remember, go to Love Thy Soccer, buy the book, pre-order it, get the scarf. It's going to be an excellent book. I have no doubt about it. And we will be sure to get Sean back on the show once the book is being released to talk about the book even more.
Yes, and if you know how to read, definitely get the book.
So that rules out Harry Redknapp.
Right.
Ah, geez. Sorry, Harry.
Well, but yeah, but you know, Harry's got enough. He could pay somebody to read it to him.
Yeah, that's true.
You know.
Oi! Speak louder, lad!
Yeah. Well, that's probably why he bought certain players, because they're the ones who can actually read the contracts to him.
Ooh, maybe that's why Nico follows him around everywhere.
But exactly.
Nico, we love you. Okay.
And that's why Defoe didn't go, because he got tired of that crap.
Yeah.
You know? Come on, Harry, time for you to learn.
Okay, so for Corey Chatelain, who will be on assignment at the Mastodon concert. This is Chad Smith. We will see you next time.
Yeah. Specialist in collapse.
This has been the Two Daft Yanks podcast. If you like the show, be sure to find the Yanks at TwoDaftYanks.com or at TwoDaftYanks on Twitter. There, you can stay up to date on all the Two Daft Yanks action by subscribing to the show.